when the shift boss hits that button, then you'd better look alive, 'cause the lumber comes a-rolling like the bees out of a hive. And you'll feel that sweat come pouring as each muscle screams with pain, and you'll wonder if it's worth it working on the long green chain.
Welcome back to the Green Chain Podcast. I'm Mark Laren Young, and today I'm talking to a Canadian filmmaker with one of the best names ever, Velcro Ripper. Velcro's first movie, Bones of the Forest, looked at logging through the eyes of Native and non-Native elders. His latest film, Fierce Light, shares stories of compassionate activism, and it receives its world premiere at the 2008 Vancouver International Film Festival, October 1st. I met Velcro in his study in his home on Toronto Island.
I want to describe your room. Can you tell me about some of the icons and, and artifacts that you've collected that are in the room right now?
Sure. Well, I have a tendency to collect various sort of spiritual objects when I travel. I travel a lot around the world. And actually, one thing I also do is whenever I'm in a room, a hotel room, anywhere, I actually build a little altar of some sort.
Cool.
And it's often stuff that I've found or I've collected as I'm traveling. It might be stones. It might be just that I find. It might be feathers that I find. It might be actual religious icons like Buddhas and things like that. So in the room, you see you have an eagle feather, which was given to me by a Native elder from Kansas when I was there. You've got a dream catcher from the Navajo people, where I'm friends with a Navajo punk rock band called Blackfire, so I like them. We've got a Sufi heart and wings on the back wall. On my main sort of table here is an altar table. There's a kind of a spiral of rocks, which I built to get it from rocks from all over the world. They're red, going to crystals that I found circling around. And and then on some of the rocks we have some icons like a red bodhisattva of compassion, Kuan Yin. We have a Shiva, so there's a male and female yin and yang kind of thing going on there. In the front we have like Dharma lions on the left and the right. They're protectors. The left is wisdom and the right is compassion, two swords of the sacred warrior.
Cool. Yeah, I like the tea lights all around them too. It looks like it's pretty special when it lights up.
Light it up, yeah. I actually ended up filming that for Fierce Light. There's a shot of an altar in there.
Okay, and the picture.
The crows, that's from Strathcona in Vancouver.
Those are crows or ravens?
Those are, well, we can call them either. My nickname is Crow, so I have an affinity for crows.
Okay.
Yeah, and that's a triptych of crows by Richard Tetreault, from a printmaker from Strathcona. And we got a Mary Magdalene painting that I got in Columbia on the corner there as well.
Very cool.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. Since we're starting on the spiritual, tell me about Scared Sacred and the sequel to Scared Sacred.
Uh-huh. Okay. Well, Scared Sacred was a journey to the scared and the sacred places of the world. It was a pilgrimage of sorts for me. And I spent 5 years making the film and traveling around the world. And I went to many of the ground zeros of the world, places like Auschwitz and Hiroshima, Cambodia, where the killing fields, Bhopal, India, and places where some of the darkest days of human history actually took place. And in those places, I looked for the sacred stories, the stories of transformation in the face of darkness. Initially, the film was going to also include the places, the sacred places I went to, the places of pilgrimage that I went to, places like Konya in Turkey, where the great Sufi saint Rumi was based and buried, and Mount Athos in Greece, and Lourdes. So those places actually... What I discovered, though, in the course of making the film, that it was actually much more interesting discovering the sacred in the places you least expect to find it than in the obvious places where you do expect to find it. So to find the sacred in the places of darkness was actually a much more valuable lesson than to find it in the places which are designed to be places of light. So that and the film kind of took a U-turn, as they always do, it seems, and went into the right into the darkness. And it's funny because I'm... If I have one of my faults is that I'm actually, it's an odd fault, is that I'm too positive a person. I mean, it can be a bit of an issue for me because I'm somebody who is just so positive that I don't necessarily look at my own shadow enough. You know, I didn't even not really had one until the last relationship I was in, when it was pointed out that, do you even know you have a shadow? Well, no. And then I learned to look at my shadow in that context. And I had done that with Scared Sacred quite organically. And I looked into almost like looking into the shadow of the world. And I think that it's in the looking at the shadow that we actually deepen ourselves as human beings, and we actually are able to be truly complete. Right? A whole person is both darkness and light. That's a whole person.
What were some of your favorite moments of Scared Sacred?
Okay. Well, Scared Sacred, I guess my favorite time was the month that I spent in the town of Bhopal, India, which is one of the most toxified cities. It's a place of a great chemical disaster, the Union Carbide disaster, which killed some 20,000 people. And the city itself has got something like 500,000 sick people in it. But what made it so special for me was that I came upon a kind of radical, alternative, free clinic that's a man named Satyu Satangath was running. And I was just so inspired by him and the activists there who had been there. Satyu had been there for 15 years since the disaster. And he was still going strong, still working to help the people there with a real sense of enthusiasm and love and energy and commitment. And I just felt the whole place really radiated with that. And there was it was a free clinic in India. There was so much money was actually pumped into restoration efforts in Bhopal, but it all went into the hands of corrupt contractors. You know, so there was like this was a corruption-free zone. It was amazing, and they weren't charging for their services. They were, you know, it was all free for the people, and it was all using a combination of Western medicine and Ayurvedic medicine, which is also really interesting, and yoga as well, and meditation practice, all combined to help heal this incredibly injured population. So that was that. Just that sense of inspiration is wonderful.
Now, how did the sequel come about? Because a sequel to a Canadian documentary, I'm not sure I've ever heard of that before.
Okay, well, first of all, we're not really calling it a sequel, per se.
Okay.
It's not, and that's really just more of a legal issue than anything. Like, we're not legally allowed to call it a sequel. So it's... it's a funny little thing. But anyways, it's not directly a sequel, but it is kind of a continuation of the exploration. And Fierce Light is the new one. And it's about the idea of spiritual activism. So in some ways, the thinking did come out of Scared Sacred, because I started realizing, well, what's the common thread that has brought these people together that I'm discovering? Because one of the things was that their source of healing was activism. That's what I found. The people in Scared Sacred, their source of what kept them alive, kept them going in the face of the great calamities they faced, beyond anything we could probably imagine. You know, imagine being in Hiroshima and being surrounded by all your friends and family dying around you, and then getting through that. And how do you cope with that? Well, the coping mechanism that really got people through was working for change, working to make sure that what had happened to them not happened to anybody else. And I realized that for the ones that really were able to transform these crises, it was a spiritual transformation more than anything. And what it came down to was a kind of alchemical combination of spirit and action. And I thought, well, I want to dive deeper into that. And I discovered, as I started looking into the idea of sacred activism, that it was actually a zeitgeist going on in the world. That old models of activism were beginning to wear out for people a little bit, and that there was a new approach emerging, and a new approach of activism that wasn't just founded on anger, that wasn't just based on reaction, but was actually based on response. A kind of activism that was about focusing on what you're for more than what you're against. A kind of activism that recognizes the interconnectedness of all issues. So it doesn't say my issue is the best issue. You know, like, you know, I'm a I'm a feminist, so I'm into the anti-nuclear movement. So why should you bother being a feminist? If the whole world's going to blow up, feminism doesn't matter. So just, you know, do my issue, you know. Or an environmental movement that is rife with racism and sexism, you know. But it's okay. We're going to save the trees. You know, there's these kind of tunnel vision that activists can sometimes fall into, which I think is old paradigm activism. I think new paradigm activism, and which I'm choosing to call sacred activism, recognizes that it's a holistic process. Just like the planet is interlocked, interrelated systems, you know, all, nothing is separate. The same thing with activism.
Okay, now, BC has been the birthplace for so many activist movements.
Uh-huh.
Are any of these sacred activist movements coming out of BC?
I think any activism can be sacred activism. Anything we do can be sacred or compassionate activism. It's just how we go about it, right? So, definitely. I mean, the environmental movement has, which was so strong, and I spent many years making films about it, definitely has a lot of those components of sacred activism in it. And I wouldn't make it black and white, like this is sacred activism, this isn't.
Okay.
You know, I think it's part of a slow evolution that's happening. But I know that, you know, in the time that I was in the environmental movement, it was still not recognizing the full interconnectedness of issues, between issues. But if any movement is suited to becoming sacred activism, in fact, it is the environmental movement, because it's an ecological model, the model of interconnectedness. If you look at an old...
You've got the Gaia model to work from, okay.
What's that?
You've got Gaia to work from, the sort of
model. Gaia, yeah. Exactly, this idea that, you know, the forest, look at the forest and the way how, you know, the mycorrhizal fungi keeps the trees alive, you know, the interconnectedness of... In fact, you can't even look at a forest is not like... A tree is not a single tree. A tree is actually interconnected with all other trees through the mycorrhizal fungi, you know, this kind of thing. Like, it's all interwoven. It's the same thing with the planet as a whole. There is no somebody else's backyard. That idea that there's somewhere else we can dump our stuff. Or, you know, global warming is an incredible unifier because it cuts across all boundaries, all nations, and it's like, oh, we're all screwed. You know, so that in a way is actually has a unifying potential. So that's one aspect of sacred activism, and there are many. Another one is that it comes from the heart, not from the head so much. You know, there was an old model on the left that, you know, if we just pummel them with facts enough, you know, if we just get enough facts, that's gonna save the world. But you know what? That doesn't save the world. We're inundated with facts. We're inundated with information.
And traditionally, if you look at elections, the people who come at you with facts tend to lose the elections.
Yeah, yeah. Now, if you're looking in the world today and talking politics, someone like Barack Obama, I think, is coming from a position of sacred activism to some extent. You know, he's echoing Martin Luther King in some of his approaches and what he's going at. And I think he is actually a representation of this zeitgeist that's happening. People are hungry for this kind of an approach. People are tired of cynicism on all sides. They're tired of polarization. They're tired of us versus them politics, us versus them activism. You know, it's like, this idea of interconnectedness is so key because, you know, when you take it to the furthest extent, like the Buddhists do, there is no other. There is no separation. You know, you recognize that, you know, that the idea in Fierce Light, we go to South Africa and we interview Archbishop Desmond Tutu, who talks about the idea of Ubuntu. And Ubuntu is the idea that I am because you are. And, you know, a single, isolated human being is actually an impossibility. The same way that a single tree is an impossibility.
Where else did you go for Fierce Light?
So Fierce Light takes us to New Zealand to meet the Maori, who are a warrior society. Oh. But actually in Parihaka in New Zealand was one of the first examples of nonviolent civil disobedience in history in the 1800s. So that's one of the stories. They talk of the idea of the sacred warrior. So we could say a spiritual activist is, in a sense, a sacred warrior. And then we go to Alabama to go into the American Civil Rights Movement. We go to India to meet the Dalits, the Untouchables, formerly known as the Untouchables, who are facing a struggle very similar to the American Civil Rights Movement right now. They're being killed for sitting on buses and going to movie theaters they're not allowed to go to. So there's this deep segregation still happening in parts of India right now. And untouchability is illegal, but it's still systemic. It's still in the society. So they're really on the front lines right now, fighting for rights. We go to South Africa. I said that already. We go to one of the main central stories is the story of South Central Farm, which is in Los Angeles. And in the wake of the Rodney King riots, 15 acres of land was given to the Latino community, and low-income families were offered a plot of land to grow their own food. And in that 15 years since the Rodney King riots, this incredible Garden of Eden grew up right in South Central LA, right in gangland LA. And it was a largely indigenous population, so they're growing heritage, indigenous foods. Yeah. Food anthropologists went down and checked this place out. It was just really a miracle, the largest urban garden in North America.
Why was it being torn down? Because I remember the stories of it being torn down. It blew my mind.
The city sold it to a developer in a backroom deal, previous administrator, and the developer, and they didn't tell the farmers, and the farmers found out. They tried to fight it in court. It was too late. Couldn't get it back, and the developer refused to sell it to them. They called and put a call out. Had a big occupation to try to save the farm.
Well, Daryl Hannah was one.
Was tree sitting. Julia Butterfly was tree sitting, and I spent a month down there. It was actually Daryl that called me up and got me down there. She's a Scared Sacred fan, and it was a remarkable occupation. It had the best food of any occupation I've ever been on, of course. There was all this organic heritage, delicious food. And just people from all over the world came. They put a call out to spiritual leaders. There were different spiritual leaders every day. There's a prayer vigil every night circling the farm. We were living in this beautiful Garden of Eden. And it was just so inspiring. And this indigenous culture just really flowered during the occupation. There was Aztec dancers and ceremonies happening. One ceremony that went on for 18 hours, a traditional ceremony they hadn't done for years and years and years to try to save the farm.
And you got to capture that on film.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. In the end, they did tear the farm down. The developer refused to budge, even though they raised $15 million, $16 million, three times what he paid for it. He refused to take it. And we found out later it was an anti-immigrant thing. Like he was like, these people should just go back to Mexico. That was basically his approach. But what's amazing is that the farmers have not given up. They actually rented a community center, kitty corner to the farm. And every month they have farmers markets. They bring in organic food to the neighborhood. They have the traditional Aztec dancers. All these bands have formed, like Farm Life, that does hip hop from the occupation, and they're still going strong. And they're not going anywhere. And no one wants to buy the land; it's sitting vacant. So they bulldozed the gardens. The gardens are gone, but they are determined to get them back and to replant.
Wow,
they're really tenacious.
Now, I mean, when I saw Scared Sacred and heard the commentary afterwards, I thought, this doesn't feel like a film. This feels like a life's work.
Right, yeah.
That's, where are you at with that?
I mean, yeah, it's always been. I mean, I've never really felt a separation between my life and my work. And definitely, it is my life's work. I consider myself a media activist. So I make films to create change in both consciousness and in society.
Because I'm just assuming whatever you do after Pierce Light will be following the same
path. Right, same path. There's two coming up. One is called Evolve or Dissolve, and that's kind of the third in the trilogy, the unofficial trilogy.
Okay.
Well,
as long as you can call yourself Velcro Ripper for all of these, I think people are going to have a hunch they're connected.
Yeah, and Evolve or Dissolve is about the idea of the evolution of consciousness, and the evolution of the planet, and the new paradigm, and where are we going as a species. And it'll sort of be tied in with 2012 a little bit, but in a non-flaky way. I'm really interested in non-flaky spirituality, because I think that and that's one of the things that I think that grounding spirit in action really does for us, because there's this, we get imbalanced, like there's a kind of transcendent spirituality that is wonderful and blissful, but takes us right out of the planet. And then there's like this materialism, which just believes there's nothing but the material world. And, you know, there's these extremes. And somewhere, bring the two together.
What is your spirituality?
Well, I used to call myself a Sufi Buddhist Baha'i punk rocker. But I...
okay.
No, I... Seriously, those are probably the closest paths I've had. I mix them all together. Currently, I am convinced that any belief system would be a limitation. So I wouldn't adopt an entire belief system. On the other hand, I'm also wary of the spiritual smorgasbord approach, which is more of a New Age approach. But ultimately, that's what I would subscribe to. This idea that we live in a world in which we have access to all the world's traditions, all the world's belief systems, and what I look for is I strip away the culture. I'm not interested in the cultural trappings of religion. I'm interested in what they're really talking about. I'm interested in the mystical heart of a belief system. And every tradition has a mystical center. So you can find truth in any tradition, I believe, but you can also find distortion in most traditions as well. You know, like, definitely Christ would be totally confused if he saw what Christianity was like right now. Very little to do with his teaching. I mean, the Catholic Church is more accurately should be called Paulinism because it was created by Paul, you know, not Christ. Most of the ideas, they kind of, you know, 200 years after he died. So, you know, and we find that again and again and again, that the culture takes on a religion and then kind of embroideries it. And a lot of that is about power broking. So I'm more interested in the direct connection with the divine, with other humans, with the planet.
Now, you said there was another film besides Evolve or Dissolve.
Yeah, Redvolution, it's called. And Redvolution is about outlaw spirituality. You know, so it's the idea of the spiritual rebel. And so it's the idea of, in this particular film, we'll go through it's a collaboration with a spiritual writer, teacher named Sarah Beek, who wrote a book called The Red Book, and so it's kind of based on her path. And red is this idea of a fiery spirituality. It's a tantric kind of spirituality, you could say, but tantric in a broad sense, not just the sexual sense, although sex is definitely part of spirituality in this path, you know, not separate, nothing is separate. It's not afraid to blow up boxes. It's like anti-box. So in the film, you'll actually see us with the different belief system, with the name, and then they'll blow up, and then you'll see, like, you know, red feathers, and then what is revealed is the red heart of that particular belief.
Okay.
For the individual, like, it's different for each person, right? So it's the idea of a spirituality that is just completely outside the boxes, and as I was saying, a spirituality that is about a direct connection. So it starts from your own inner truth, as opposed to an externally imposed truth. That's tricky, because you could just end up narcissistic, right? So it actually takes a real dedication to sift through your own ego to truth.
Now, you've started as an environmental filmmaker.
Let's see. My very first film...
Was it Bones of the Forest?
No. That was like my 10th.
Okay.
My very first film was called Iran the Crisis. That was about the revolution in Iran.
Okay.
Shah being deposed. The second was called No Means No, and that was about acquaintance rape. Social issue. And then the third big one, my first feature, was called I'm Happy, You're Happy, We're All Happy, 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 Happy. And that was more of they called it a Koyaanisqatsi by Monty Python, or The Stalker by Pee Wee Herman. So,
okay.
I'm actually a way funnier guy than you might think. You know, it's kind of funny because, you know, like in Scared Sacred, I just seem so serious in a way, you know?
Pretty much, yeah.
But I'm not at all, you know? It's almost like that these films...
There's not a whole lot of wacky humor coming from Bhopal.
No, but there is, you know? I mean, there is room for a little bit of humor in every situation. I mean, you certainly... You know, where I find the funniest people are indigenous people. You know, like, their greatest sense of humor, you know, and they're some of the people who have experienced the most oppression in history, you know, and yet humor becomes a survival tactic. You know, Archbishop Desmond Tutu is hilarious. At one point I asked him, do you think God has a sense of humor? And he said, absolutely. Look at the creatures God has created. Look at me, you know, short and stumpy with a big nose. And then God has to say, I love him. And then he just cracks up. So humor, I think, is really important. And I'm trying to work more of it in. And there's a whole side of my filmmaking, which I was like absurdist filmmaking. You know,
okay.
I made all these animations. Like I'm Happy has like this whole hamburger meat animation scene, which is just really quite funny, actually. And in Fierce Light, I'm looking to try to get some humor in. But again, it's like Sacred Warrior, you know, it's like.
Well, can you talk about some of your environmental films, like Bones of the Forest,
sure.
and what you learned,
yeah.
and what you took away from what you saw?
Mm-hmm. Bones of the Forest is a feature documentary.
Which is impossible to find now, by the way.
Yeah, it doesn't. I'm the only distributor. And Heather. It's co-directed with Heather Fries. Finished in 95. And before the era of theatrical releases and that kind of stuff, you know, it just was on TV. It was a... Who did we sell it? It was TVO, I think, broadcast it. But it was a 16mm feature film.
Okay.
And took 5 years to make. Another one of these five-year projects. And we lived in the old-growth forest. You know, we lived in the Walbrand Valley on the blockades. And we lived in a houseboat in Clackwood Sound, you know, on the blockades for years. And it really... It was a story of elders. You had to be 70 or older to get into that film. And it was all Native and non-Native elders talking about the forest and the struggle to save the forest. And it was such an honor to just get to meet all these incredible elders, you know, these great repositories of wisdom that are often so neglected in our society. I think that was one of the greatest gifts of Bones of the Forest, was just this opportunity to meet these amazing people who are so marginalized and so often. You know, it was also an honor to be able to go into the Native communities and to be welcomed and to meet them. And we were really, in that film, trying to heal a split that was quite real in the environmental movement between in Native and non-Native activists, you know. Because there is a tendency in the environmental movement to kind of see Native people as potentially allies, but also potentially in the way. To saving a park or creating a park or something, right? And there's not this sense of real understand. There hasn't been. I think it's changing, but there hasn't been the sense of real deep understanding of the issues that Native people care about, you know. And it's not so simple, and you really need to go with an open heart and ability to listen, as opposed to fixed ideas.
Now, because nobody's going to be able to find this film unless they call you directly, can you tell us what people come away with, you know, if you watch the film, what are you going to come away with?
I think you're going to come away with a sense of the beauty of the old growth forest. You're going to come away with a sense of the spin that the logging companies will put out. One of the characters is the vice president of McMillan Bloedel, and you just see the kind of how they start to believe their own rhetoric. You know, there's this line in the film that's quoting Goebbels, the PR guy for Hitler, and he says, never tell a truth if a lie will do. Always tell a half-truth if you can, because a half-truth is better than a lie. You can't prove it, and you disprove it. And if you tell a lie often enough, even the liar will begin to believe it.
Sorry.
Those are the principles of greenwashing.
Somebody actually said this.
Goebbels said that. I said it in the... We said it in the
okay.
film. Merv Wilkinson says it. Merv Wilkinson says it. Talking about...
PR. I mean, isn't Merv sort of an environmentally friendly logger?
Yes.
Yeah,
he's
okay.
criticizing green,
okay.
greenwashing.
I figured I better clarify that because
We're talking about greenwashing, which is when...
So he was explaining the concepts of greenwashing.
Yeah. Which is when, you know, logging companies or, you know, environmentally destructive companies hire someone like Burston Marsteller to come in and make them look good.
Because my understanding is sort of one of the, you know, original... environmentally conscious loggers.
Merv's in the film as a sustainable logger.
Okay.
And he's that's another thing you'll take away with, is that it's possible to actually log and enhance the forest. I mean, you look at Merv's Wildwood land where he's logged for 40 years has all the properties of an old growth forest, you know. And he selectively logs it, and he gets a yield from that that's sustainable for him. So you can log in a way. It's just greed. Clear cutting is just greed, and short term greed, because these companies have no allegiance to the local economy. You know, this global mindset is that we'll just use up this forest and then we can always go to Brazil. You know, we'll finish off BC, then we'll go to Brazil. You know, there's no commitment to sustainability.
What are some of the other things you came away with covering the front lines of the environmental movement in BC?
I got a real sense of the dedication of these activists, you know, people willing to put themselves on the front line. And I love the elder activists, you know, like Ruth Masters, one of my heroes from Courtney. And she, you know, she's, I don't know what now, must be in her late 80s. But, you know, Ruth is somebody who's just, she knows what's right. She knows what's wrong. And she's talking to those cops like they're little boys, you know. Now listen here, Sonny, if you cared about the environment, you would not be arresting me, would you? You know, and she's she plays her harmonica and plays "Oh Canada, Glorious and Free" as people are being arrested. Kind of squeaks it out. I come away with a sense of the pricelessness of old growth forests. There's 3% left. I don't know what it is, 2% left. They are 10,000 year old works of art that can never be replaced. You know, this is something that we really need to get into our heads. A tree farm, even a restoration attempt, you know, a multi-species restoration attempt, which is very rarely done, it's mostly just tree farms they replace clear cuts with, has nothing like the incredible grandeur of these old growth forests. They're, you can just feel the primeval quality of them. And the film captures that, I think, to some extent, because of the cinematography, and that's one of the ideas. And then the sense that, just that sense that the native communities are the best stewards for this land. And
why do you feel that way?
I just intrinsically. Now it's complicated because we're dealing with a colonized people, you know. But I think that I feel that way because they traditionally have been, because they're the ones who often live there, and given the right circumstances, would be able to use the land sustainably, because traditionally they have known how to use the land sustainably, and we're seeing, you know, time and time again, we're seeing that when there is a healthy collaboration between environmentalists and the native community, there's great power there, enormous power.
How do you feel about trees?
Oh, I love trees. Trees are remarkable. Trees are, they move slower than us. They have a different time frame, you know. I mean, especially 1,000-year-old trees are just amazing. I mean, Julia Butterfly is one of the characters in the new film, and we've got this, you know, just this footage of her, you know, 2 years sitting in that ancient tree, and when you see her coming down and her feet finally touching the earth, for me, trees are a wonderful metaphor for the environment as a whole, and they're so critical to our nature itself is so critical to our well-being. You know, we're suffering from a nature deficit disorder in our society today, and it's a serious issue. Kids are growing up never having climbed a tree, you know, and it's really affecting our psychological health. You see that.
If somebody put you in charge of forest policy for Canada, mm-hmm. what would you do?
I would eliminate unsustainable practices. And I would say we have to consider 7 generations and seriously consider it. Is there going to be a forest here 7 generations from now with these practices? If not, we need to change our practices.
Cool. Thank you very much.
Okay. You're welcome.
Coming up on future podcasts, activist Betty Krasick. And I'll be talking to some of the people involved with my movie, The Green Chain, which is premiering in Canadian theaters this fall. Thanks for joining me for The Green Chain Podcast. At the Tai'i, I'm Mark Laren-Young.